So cappuccinos are really, really good, right? Yay, cappuccino. The problem is that the cappuccinos, the bistro staff needs to charge for the cappuccinos. Everything else that you see is free. Cappuccinos, we need to charge. And so then that charge racks up on the ISSYP bill, and then the people in charge of the ISSYP bill look at that and say, "Whoa, 1,400 cappuccinos! This is no good." Okay, so we can't have cappuccinos for free. Sorry, everything else is okay. Coffee? I don't think coffee. Coffee's okay, right? The coffee and the tea and the carrots. The carrots are free. Yeah. Okay. Eat lots of carrots. Okay. All right. So we've got about an hour. So what I want to do is talk a little bit about go further here with our quantum stuff. And one of the most important concepts in understanding the quantum nature of our universe, one of the quirky things about quantum theory that has one of the most dramatic impacts on the nature of the universe is something called zero-point energy. Okay, so we're going to talk about that. Okay, so you remember that when we were dealing with that harmonic oscillator, that ball rolling around in the bowl, we discovered that the lowest energy is not zero. The lowest energy is E0, some number bigger than zero, and then we had energy levels up like that, discrete energy levels. The question is, how does this arise? Why does this arise? Why is it bigger than zero? Okay, profound consequences, but let's first understand why. Okay, so let's go back to the ball in the bowl. Okay, so the ball and the bowl, this is the x-axis, and then the y is the vertical. And we stick the ball in the bowl, and classically, in a Newtonian universe, what this thing does is it just rolls back and forth like this, between an amplitude of plus a through zero, as far left as minus a. Okay? So in a classical world, what is the energy? If the amplitude is between plus and minus a, what is the energy classically? We did it yesterday. 1 over 2 ka squared. So it's a 1 half ka squared. Okay, and k here is proportional to how steep this bowl is. So if the bowl is very steep, then the k value is large. If the bowl is very shallow, then the k value is small. Okay? And then for a given k value, a given steepness of bowl, depending upon the amplitude of the oscillation back and forth, that's how much energy. If I give it more energy, it's going to oscillate back and forth with a wider amplitude. Okay? And vice versa. So classically, what is the minimum energy? What is A when E is zero? So the minimum value that we can get classically is zero. And that happens when A is equal to zero. Okay? So that's down here. Okay, but in the real world, i.e. the quantum world, it's not like that. Okay, we want to understand why it's not like that. Okay, so quantum. If A is zero, what is the position of the particle? Middle. What value of x? Zero. So if A is equal to zero, that means it's not oscillating. That means it's just sitting at the bottom. Its position, its x component of position is permanently zero. So x equals zero. Exactly. Permanently. It's just sitting there. There's no uncertainty. It's definitely zero. It's not like in some range or whatever. We know it's definitely located right there. It's located exactly at x equals 0 with no uncertainty. So delta x equals what? What we called our uncertainty is just 0. Because x is 0 definitely. Okay, don't get confused with this 0 and this 0. We could have had it located at x equals 5 definitely. As long as it's definite, the delta x is 0. Okay, so okay, because x has a definite value, delta x is 0. Okay, so then delta p, according to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, the uncertainty in the momentum is what? Greater than or equal to what? And? The Heisenberg uncertainty principle states delta x delta p is greater than or equal to h over 4 pi. So what is delta p? Okay, we divide by delta x. Okay, if delta x is 0, what is the right-hand side? It's infinite. Okay, as I make delta x smaller and smaller and smaller, as I make the certainty, as I make my certainty of the position smaller and smaller and smaller, become more and more certain of the position, my uncertainty of momentum increases unboundedly. Okay, so what that means is, sure, okay, fine. I can have that one instant of time, I can be certain that the particle is there. It's exactly at x equals 0. But its momentum, the uncertainty of momentum is huge. Okay, so it has this huge sort of claustrophobicness. Okay, and so it has this huge momentum, some totally random huge momentum. In the next second, it's going to have just jumped some huge distance because it's got this huge momentum. Okay, so yeah, it started out at this position, but its momentum is some random huge number. So in the next second, it's going to be way over there or way over there. Okay, so it's instantly going to jump into motion. That's important. Okay, so so it instantly jumps into motion, and its amplitude of vibration is no longer 0. So A is not 0. So if we had A equals 0, because of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, it can't do that. And suddenly and instantly, A is not 0. Okay, so we can't have A equals 0. We can't have it sitting at the bottom. Okay, it's got to be doing something. Okay, and it has this 0-point motion. So let's talk a bit about that. So the energy is kinetic plus potential. Okay, the kinetic energy is 1/2 mv squared. What is that in terms of momentum? P squared over 2m. And the kinetic energy is just 1/2 kx squared. Okay, so the further it is, say to the right, the larger its potential energy. Okay, grows quadratically with x in either direction. Okay, now the idea here is, in we know that in the classical world, this particle, if it has some amplitude of oscillation, it's on a definite trajectory. On the x-axis, we just see it going back and forth with some harmonic kind of motion. Okay? In the quantum world, we know that it doesn't have a definite trajectory. We talked about that in regards to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. It's doing something funny. There's no definite trajectory. It's in this weird state in which all we can say about it are probabilities, probability of finding it here or there at any given instant of time. Okay, so we're going to imagine it as sort of just in this random kind of motion. So what we're going to do is we're going to take many snapshots. Okay, we're going to take many snapshots of the situation. So here it is. Don't really know quite what it's doing. It's not on any kind of a definite trajectory. It's doing some weird kind of fuzzy kind of quantum thing. Okay, and I'm going to take many, many snapshots of it. And I'm going to measure the x position of it at various instants of time. Okay, so at one instant of time, I might find that, oh, it's there. Okay, the next snapshot I might find, oh, it's there. Next snapshot I might find, oh, it's there. So I take these a series of x values. Okay, so let's see. So I do that, and similarly for momentum and all that stuff. So taking many snapshots and averaging, that process will be indicated by putting brackets around the symbol. So the average value of E after taking many snapshots and averaging will equal, we apply that process to this side as well. So it means take a measurement of the momentum of the particle and square it and take the average and so on. We'll talk about this in a second. So taking many snapshots and averaging, we do that for both the momentum and the x, and that will give us, in some sense, the average value of the energy, the mean value of the energy. So let's apply this process to the case of position first, and then of momentum. Okay, so what do we got? So on this x-axis here, there's zero. On this x-axis, I'm going to plot the results of our various snapshots. Okay, so in the first snapshot, I might find, oh, the particle's x position is this. In the next snapshot, I might find, oh, the particle's x position is that. And the next one, it's over there. Next snapshot, it's over there. Next one's there. Next one's there, and so on. Okay, so these snapshots, the particle, I see it in different positions. Okay, if I were to take a whole bunch of such snapshots and average them, what value do you think I will get? What is the average value of, say, the position? Zero. Okay, it's zero just because of the symmetry of the problem. Okay, our bool is symmetric on both sides. It's equally likely to be found on either side. So if I average over a long time, over a large number of values, obviously I'm going to get zero. Okay. But that's not what this is asking. This is asking for the average value of x squared. Okay, we get an average value of x equal to zero because some are positive and some are negative. When we square that, they're all positive numbers, and the average ain't going to be zero. Okay, so if I take this guy over here, I square that, I get a positive number. Okay, take this guy over here, I square that, I get a positive number. This guy over here, it's negative, I square it, I also get a positive number over there. And so on. So I build up a whole bunch of x's on the right-hand side of zero. The average value sits somewhere over here, say, which is not zero. Okay, so the average value of x squared is definitely greater than zero. Okay, so they're all positive. All right. So now, what I want to do is actually get an estimate for what that value is. Get a feeling for the size, the magnitude of that value. Okay, so it turns out that x squared is equal to delta x squared. Okay, so this number that we're looking for, okay, what is the average value of x squared? Is actually equal to our uncertainty in x squared. Okay. Now this is a result of first of all, it seems plausible, right? Seems plausible that I don't actually know where this particle is. I have some uncertainty. Sometimes I measure it's over there. Sometimes it's over there. Sometimes it's over there. So I don't actually know. And when it's sitting there doing this weird quantum thing, okay, whatever that kind of thing is that it's doing in the bottom of the bowl there. I don't actually know where it is at any time. Sometimes I would find it over there, sometimes over there, and so on. But I don't actually know. There's uncertainty. There's uncertainty in its position. Okay? It's reasonable to imagine that our uncertainty in the position, the square of that, is the same thing as this number, x squared. Does that seem plausible? How many of you are having trouble with that? You're having trouble with that?
Yep.
Why? So I've got this guy. It's doing this weird quantum thing back and forth. Okay. So when it's in that state, I don't actually know where it is. So do you believe that delta x is non-zero?
Yeah.
Okay. So roughly speaking, suppose it has some amount of energy. That means that it's going to be doing this weird quantum thing within some range of the x-axis. Okay. And that range of the x-axis is going to be a measure of the of our uncertainty in the position of the electron. And if I take a bunch of measurements, once I find it there, once I find it there, once there, once there, once there, if I average over those squared values, that will give me sort of a measure of my uncertainty of this spread. If I take all these x values and square them and average it, it will give me a measure of this spread squared. Does that seem plausible then?
Yeah.
Okay. In fact, it turns out that in the case of harmonic motion like this, if you do the mathematics with Schrodinger's equation and you define exactly what this thing is, so far this is a vague concept, but if you define it mathematically, you can show that this is in fact exactly true. Mathematically. Okay, within the structure of quantum theory, if you do the math. Okay, and but what is the okay, so what we've done is we've drawn a connection between our the average value of our measurements of x squared and this concept of uncertainty, okay, which is going to be important. Okay, but what is the value, what is the actual value of it? Is it 5? Is it 2? How can we get an estimate of the actual value? How is it related to the amplitude, do you think? Suppose I'm saying that the particle is doing some fuzzy, weird quantum thing in here, and roughly speaking, the amplitude is about this big. It's not this big. Okay, it's very rare that I will find an electron out here. I mostly find them kind of in this kind of region over here. And so I put a rough number there. That's my amplitude. That's the size of the quantum fuzziness happening. How would this amplitude A be related to this? It's equal. Okay, this is a length, and I've squared it, meters squared. This is a length, and I've squared it meters. They're both meters squared. So these two guys are equal up to maybe some factor. Maybe this is 1.2 times a squared or whatever. Okay, so it's basically equal. Let's say approximately. Okay, this gives us an order of magnitude field. So what we're saying here is that our uncertainty in the position, if I square that, that's roughly equal to the amplitude of the oscillation. The amplitude of this weird quantum fuzziness. So A is the amplitude of quantum fuzzy motion, technically zero point motion. Okay? So a little bit of this, so this is a little bit of arm waving. Okay? So we're this is what physicists do a lot of. They do this kind of thinking. Very important way to think. If you can't proceed exactly, you need to be able to just think in terms of just sort of common sense and get a feel for it. Okay, so we got that. Next. Similarly, let's look at the momentum. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to measure the momentum of that particle when it's in this quantum fuzzy state here, multiple times. Okay, so I measure it once here. So I have a bunch of systems that are in identical states. Okay, I measure one of them and I find, oh, in that case, in one case, the momentum was positive and had this magnitude. In the next case, I found, oh, it was moving to the left. I find it over there with a greater magnitude. You know, sometimes, then the next one is over there and so on and so forth. And I accumulate a whole bunch of data points. What is the average value of P? Zero again. Okay? It's equally likely I'll find it moving to the right as moving to the left. Okay. But I'm not interested in the average value of P. I'm interested in the average value of P squared. Okay, so all of those negative ones will become positive, and again I get a bunch of data points that are all positive, clustered like this. The average value is somewhere like that. Okay, so the average value of P squared is now definitely greater than 0. Again, they're all positive. Okay, so now let's try to get an estimate of the magnitude of p squared. What is the actual number? Well, it turns out that p squared, for the exact same reason that the average reality of x squared is actually the mathematical definition of uncertainty squared in position, the same applies to momentum. Okay, now that we have it in this form, delta p is an uncertainty in momentum. And we have an equation for that. We have the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Relates, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle relates delta p to delta x. So delta p squared is then what? Greater than or equal to, what am I going to write on the right-hand side? Delta p by itself is h divided by, thank you, and then I square the whole thing. Okay? And what do I know? I know that delta x squared, I just figured that out, delta x squared is approximately just the amplitude of the fuzziness squared. So that's an h squared over 16 pi squared a squared. Okay? Right. Yeah, no, that's right. Okay, so let's go back to this equation over here now and plug that in. So that tells us that the average value of the energy is 1 over 2m times this plus 1/2 k times the average value of x squared, which is a squared. Okay. So I want to emphasize here what we're doing here. This guy here is classical. This is true in the classical world. In a Newtonian universe, the average value of the energy would simply be this. We have an additional term here. This is a potential energy term. This is a kinetic energy term. That term comes from the claustrophobic nature of particles. Okay, so if I try to confine a if I have a particle confined to a big box, it's fine with that, and it has this zero point motion. It just kind of moseys about. Okay, if I try to make the box smaller, it freaks out. Okay, and it has this crazy large random kind of momentum. There's this. And momentum is associated with kinetic energy. Kinetic energy is p squared over 2m. If there's a p, there's a kinetic energy. So this is a kinetic energy term, and it's purely quantum mechanical. I need to emphasize that. I can't emphasize this enough. Purely quantum effect. Okay. It does not exist in Newton's universe. Okay. You'll notice that it's proportional to h. It's proportional to Planck's constant. Whenever you have anything that has Planck's constant in it, then you know that it's not true in the classical universe, in Newton's universe. So it disappears. If Planck's constant just didn't exist. Okay? And one thing you'll notice is that as A gets smaller, as this sort of quantum fuzziness, as the size of our system gets smaller and smaller and smaller, this purely quantum mechanical kinetic energy term gets larger and larger and larger because A is in the denominator. Okay? So it acquires a purely quantum mechanical kinetic energy, which grows bigger the smaller the system is. Okay? Whereas this guy's the opposite. This is a purely classical potential energy, which grows smaller the system is. Okay? So let me just sort of say that. So this guy here is classical potential energy, which goes down as A goes down. This guy over here is a quantum kinetic energy, which goes up as A goes down. Okay, they're reverse. One of them is proportional to A squared. One of them is proportional to 1 over A squared. So what I want to do is I want to estimate the size of a system the size of this system. I want to estimate what A squared is, or what A is. I want to try to come up with a guess of what A should be. What should the minimum size of a system be? Okay, so the way we're going to do that is we're just going to plot. We have this equation here. We have this average value of E depends upon A. It's some function of A. Okay, it's some constant times 1 over A squared plus some constant times A squared. It's a 1 over A squared plus A squared. I'm going to graph that curve. Okay, so here is my value of A. And here is my value, the second term. The classical potential energy term grows quadratically with A. So this is classical potential energy 1/2 kA squared. It's quadratic in A. Okay? If this were all that were present, then we would say, well, the minimum energy of the system, this is the vertical axis here is energy. The minimum energy of this curve is 0, and that occurs when A is 0. But we've already discovered we can't have A equals 0 because it would instantly kick the system into motion, okay, by the Heisenberg uncertainty. So we have this purely quantum mechanical kinetic energy term, which is a 1 over A squared. Okay, 1 over A squared curve looks like that. So this is the quantum kinetic energy, which is H squared over whatever that is, times 1 over A squared. So proportional to 1 over A squared. And 1 over A squared curves look like this. As A gets bigger, the curve gets smaller. As A gets smaller, the curve blows up to infinity here. Okay? So now that this equation tells us that we're supposed to add these guys up. There's a plus sign there. Well, let's add those two curves. Okay, so let's see. How do I add two curves? If I take the value of the curve, say I choose this point, if I take the value of the curve of this curve at this point plus this curve at this point, well, it's just double this value. Okay, so that's that point up there. If I look at this point over here, I take this point, I take this height plus this height. Okay, that means that high. And say at this point over here, I take this height and I add to it that height. And I go up like that. And over here, I take this height and I add to it that height. So it's like that. Okay, so I just connect the dots now. And what I have is a curve like that. Okay? So what does this curve mean? Well, it says that this is the energy, the total energy of the system, as a function of the size of the system, the size of the weird quantum fuzziness. Okay, so here is this weird quantum fuzziness. Okay, and this is roughly the size of it between A and minus A. Okay? And now I'm asking the question, what size of system, what size of quantum fuzziness will minimize the energy of the system? Things tend to go to a state of minimum energy. What size will minimize it? What point on this graph am I interested in? The very bottom point. I'm interested in this point. That's the minimum total energy. Okay? And there is a minimum. That's the point. Okay, and that, well, there is a minimum also classically, but it occurs at A equals 0. Because of this purely quantum mechanical curve here, it pulls this classical curve up and it becomes this curve. It pulls this guy up and it makes a new minimum sitting over here, sitting in a non-zero value of A, which we'll call A0. And if the system has this size A0, okay, of quantum fuzziness, then the energy in it will be minimum, and the value of the energy will be the height on this axis corresponding to that point. Okay? So now we're faced with a mathematical problem. I would like to determine what A0 is, and then correspondingly what is E0. Okay? How am I going to do that? Calculus! Yay, calculus! Okay? So we have a choice. I can either show you how to do this with calculus, or we can just skip and I'll tell you the answer. How many would like to see the calculus? Okay, all of you. Okay, most of you. Okay. 90% of you. Okay, so even if you don't know calculus, don't worry. I'm just going to go through this quickly. The answer, well, all I want to point out is there is an answer. This is a definite curve here, and if we develop the mathematical machinery, we should be able to figure out exactly what it is. I'll show you the mathematical machinery. If you haven't done calculus before, don't worry about it. And I'll kind of explain what I'm doing along the way. But I'm not gonna derive calculus. Because that's gonna take us forever. Okay, so basically we're solving. Okay, so we solve for A0. So what we do is E here, E is a function. This is E. And it's some kind of a function of A. And so what we do is we take the derivative of that. What the derivative means is find the slope. Find the slope of this curve. Okay? So let's actually do it graphically just really quickly here. Okay, so the slope of the curve graphically. Okay, I don't think red shows up very well. How about a nice green? Okay. So at this value of x, or a, sorry, what is the value of the slope here? Is it negative or is it positive? So it's negative slope over here. What is the value of the slope here? Is it negative or positive? Is it its magnitude bigger or less than here? Bigger. Okay? What about the slope here? It's also negative, and the magnitude of the slope is less. What about the slope here? Slope here is zero. That's what we're looking for. We're looking for where the slope is zero. Okay? Slope here is what?
Positive.
Slope here is what? Is it bigger or less in magnitude? Okay. So what we're going to do is superimpose on this curve a picture of the slope. The slope is, oh, okay, it's going to be a little messy. So let's put zero over here. Zero height over here. So this is the derivative. Okay. So the slope is zero here. The slope is negative as we go here and gets increasingly negative. So the slope goes like that, down like that. Okay, the slope over here is all positive and getting more positive. Actually, because that's quadratic, it's a straight line. Sorry. All right. Okay. It actually looks like that. Okay. So what we're looking for is where is the slope equal to zero? Well, right over there. Actually, it's not a straight line. Sorry. This part of it is quadratic, one of it is a 1 over x squared. So I did have it right. Anyways, the point is we're looking for a zero. Okay. So and the way that you take the derivative, this is the derivative of a polynomial. So I'm not going to tell you how you do this, but I'll just show you the answer. So we're gonna take this, we're gonna call this guy some constant alpha. We're gonna call this guy some constant beta. And we're going to write E as alpha times 1 over a squared plus some other constant beta times a squared. Okay? For those of you who do know calculus, what is the derivative of 1 over a squared?
Minus
2 over a cubed. So it's minus 2 alpha over a cubed. What is the derivative of a squared?
2a.
Okay, so it's that. Okay, so now we're setting, what we want to do is find the value of A where that slope is zero. So this curve over here, that function of A is this curve right here. And you'll notice that we do have the linear term in there, that's the straight line, but we also have a negative 1 over A cubed. So it's basically almost a straight line out here, but then it's a negative 1 over A cubed. So it looks actually like that. Okay, we're looking for where it passes through zero. So we just set this equal to zero and solve for A. Okay, so that's simple algebra. I'll just tell you the answer. So it turns out that A, or the special value of A, A0 here that we're looking for, turns out to be some ratio of alpha to beta. In fact, it turns out to just be, so A0 squared turns out to be the square root of alpha over beta. And I'll leave that as an exercise for you to do. Okay, so plug in alpha over beta. We know alpha, we know beta. Grind it all out, and what you get is h divided by 4 pi times the square root of mk mass times the shape of the bowl. Okay? So what we've got here is the value of A0. A0 is equal to that number right there. Okay, it depends upon Planck's constant. It would be 0 if Planck's constant were 0. It also depends upon the mass and the shape of the bowl. Okay, so now that we know the value of A0, how do we figure out E0? So A0 squared is the square root. Because if you look at this, if I multiply through by a cubed, I will get a constant plus something times a to the fourth. So it's a quartic equation. And then I take the square root of a quartic, and that gives me a quadratic. So a0 squared is a square root. Okay? So now that I know the value of a0, how do I determine e0? I plug it into this equation, right? I just plug in for A here, I plug in A0, and that will determine E. Okay, so again, I'm not going to go through that. I'll just tell you the answer. So plugging that in, we get E0, which is the value of E when we stick for A, we stick in A0. Okay, and you crank it out, and what you find is it works out very simply. Turns out to be 1/4 HF plus 1/4 HF. Well, the first 1/4 HF comes from the purely quantum mechanical kinetic energy term. The second quarter HF comes from the purely classical potential energy term. Okay, so in fact, what we're seeing is the minimum is actually here. So this curve is actually like that. The minimum is there. And half of it comes from potential, and half of it comes from kinetic, such that the total sum is 1/2 HF. So what it's saying is that the minimum energy of a ball rolling around in a bowl is not zero, as you would expect classically. But because of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, there's this weird quantum fuzziness, this weird zero-point motion. And the energy corresponding to that zero-point motion, the minimum energy the system can have, is 1/2 Planck's constant times the natural frequency of a ball rolling back and forth in a bowl. Okay, and so if we go back to our energy level diagram, if that's zero down there, what we've done is we've actually figured out what E0 is. And that's the 1/2 HF. And we didn't actually do the calculation, but I asked you to believe me that for a quadratic, it's a very special shape. For a quadratic bowl, the energy levels are very nice. They're evenly spaced. It's an HF there, HF, HF, and so on. And we talked a little bit about the meaning of this. When you apply these kinds of, or when you do quantum field theory, which is the basis of the mathematics of the standard model, quarks, leptons, all that stuff, and photons, these jumps HF correspond to, like in the case of photons, they correspond to numbers of photons. So if the system has this energy, it means there's one photon in it. If the system has this energy, it means there's two photons in it, and so on. That's the meaning of a photon. Okay? So what? Well, let's apply this to something that's more more important than a ball rolling around in a bowl. Let's apply this to something which occurs everywhere. That is ubiquitous. Okay? An atom. Atoms are ubiquitous. They occur everywhere, everywhere. Okay? We see them all around us, and let's apply it to that case. Okay, so we'll apply it to the hydrogen atom, because that's, if we understand the hydrogen atom, we understand all atoms, right? Okay, so the hydrogen atom is an example of a bound particle system, okay, in the same way that our particle in a box is a bound particle system. So let me just draw the particle in the bowl, not the box, the bowl. Okay, so let's see here. This is the potential energy. the potential energy as a function of x. As we increase x, the potential energy gets bigger, right? The gravitational potential energy. And so the vertical axis we can interpret as an energy axis. So instead of the y-axis, we'll think of it as the energy axis. Okay? And what we notice, what quantum mechanics tells us, is that the energy is, it can't be just be, it, the system can't have just any energy. The energies are discrete, okay, and we figured them out. That's half HF, 1.5 HF, 2.5 HF, 3.5 HF, and so on. Okay, so we have discrete energy levels. And in particular, we have this E0. Okay? Now let's look at a hydrogen atom. What is a hydrogen atom? Hydrogen atom is a proton and an electron. Okay, and this electron is held toward the proton with a force, electrostatic attractive force. Okay, in the same way that the ball in the bowl is held in. Okay, if it's over here, it feels a force essentially this way, it rolls it down here. If it's on this side, it feels a force this way, pulling it back toward the center. There's always something pulling it back toward the center. Same for the electron. The electron, if it's on this side, it gets pulled this way. If the electron is on this side, it gets pulled this way. It always feels a force toward the center. Okay, and so it's bound. It's bound in that. And so if we're dealing with a ball in a bowl, the potential energy of the ball as a function of its distance from the center looks like that. Okay, for the case of a hydrogen atom, the potential energy of the electron in relation to, suppose it's a radial distance r away from the proton. Does anyone know what the potential energy is? Yeah. Okay. Anyone else see that? Anyone else? How many of you have studied studied electrostatics? Okay. So you have no excuse. You should know what this is. So what it is a negative k times e squared divided by r. So k is some constant. In some notation, k is written 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. Okay, whatever, it's just some constant. The point is, it's a negative, and it's a 1 over distance. Okay, so when r is large, the potential energy is 0. As r gets smaller, 1 over r gets larger, and there's a negative sign, so it becomes more negative. Okay, so if we were to plot that potential, r here, we would find that the potential energy looks like this. For large values of r, it's nearly 0. As r gets smaller, the potential energy gets larger in magnitude, but it's always negative. So it goes down like that. Okay, so that's if it's, say, on the right-hand side of the atom. If it's on the left, this is kind of an abusive notation because r is only positive. But what we will imagine then instead is we'll just say, suppose we're just considering the x-axis here. Okay, so if it's to the right or to the left. But this is a typical abusive notation that physicists use. Okay, so we got that, and so this is an energy, and this is the potential energy, minus k e squared over r, where e is the charge of the electron. Okay, so the proton and the electron have the same magnitude of charge, which we're calling e. Okay, so what else? Okay, now there are energy levels. You know that the atom has discrete energy levels. Does anyone remember what the lowest energy level is? 1s, that's right. 1s is the name of the state that it's in. Okay, so that's the same as when the ball is in its lowest energy state at the very bottom, the one that has 0 point energy. That's the 1s state. Does anyone remember numerically what the energy is? Well, first of all, it's negative. It's an energy level down here. E0 turns out to be negative 13.6 electron volts. That's a number that you should just have in your head. Okay, so that's the lowest energy state. But of course, there are higher energy states from chemistry. What are some of the names of the orbitals? That's right, all that stuff. S, P, D, E, F, G, H, J, K, all I know is X. Okay, and so these energy levels They actually, I don't think it goes up to set. These energy levels, their spacing is not equal. Okay, so as we go to higher energy levels, the spacing between the levels gets smaller. Okay, and then we get zillions of energy levels. I should just I'm not doing this very well, but anyways. Okay, so it becomes nearly continuous. Well, it becomes continuous as we approach zero. What if the particle has energy up there? What does that mean? It's not on the atom. It's not bound by the atom. It's free of the atom. Okay, it has been the electron has been ionized. We have an ion now. The electron flies freely. The electron flies freely through space and just leaves the presence of the proton. Okay, so bound states are all energy lower than zero, and the important thing is there is a lowest energy. Okay, this just doesn't keep on going down to minus infinity. Okay, and so let me just say one thing here just quickly, because we do want to wrap. We have 10 minutes. Wow, that's tons of time. Okay. Okay, so here is the problem. Here's the situation. We got Newton, we got Maxwell, we got all these people, right? They figure stuff out about the universe, blah blah. And then we reach a certain point in history. A guy called Rutherford comes along, and using the best ideas so far and the best experimental evidence and everything, he comes to a certain point. Okay. I think it's 19, you guys remember 19? Don't ask a physicist dates ever. You know, if they get the right century, they're doing well. It's in the early 1900s, Rutherford came along. And so in other words, all of physics reached a certain point. And that point was this. This was how they understood the atom. They understood the atom as some nucleus, some heavy nucleus, in the center, which we now know as the proton, and some electron, some very light particle. These are both basically point particle-like objects, okay? And there is an attractive force between them, which varies as 1 over r squared. It's the electrostatic attraction. What kind of a force, what other force in nature does that remind you of?
Gravity.
Okay, and this looks a lot like the sun and the earth. We're under a gravitational force of attraction, bound system. So what is the orbit of this guy? What does this guy do? It circles around, or maybe it goes in an ellipse. But let's just draw a circle to keep it simple. I have trouble enough drawing a circle. An ellipse is going to be a disaster. OK, so this guy's going around in a circle, in a circular orbit like this. Okay. That's it. All of classical physics takes and experimental measurements take us to this point. Rutherford comes up with this planetary model of the atom. This is the best they can do. Does anyone know? Can anyone think of a problem with this? Yeah. Okay. Right. What is the source of all light? Classically, what is the source of all light? Accelerated charge particles. Okay? So how do I make light? Well, I make light by grabbing a charged particle, jiggle it around like this, and it emits electromagnetic waves. Okay? If I'm jiggling it at this frequency, you'll pick it up on a radio receiver at like really low frequency. Okay? I'd have to jiggle it like super fast to make light, but if I could jiggle my hand fast enough, my hand would glow and I would emit light. Okay. That ain't gonna happen soon. I mean, I gotta go to the gym and really work out for that one. Okay, so there we go. So this guy is accelerating. Okay, even though the speed is not changing, this guy's accelerating. What kind of an acceleration? What's the name for that acceleration? What direction is it? Directed toward the center. So there is an acceleration. The magnitude of the acceleration is what? So if this is the speed v and this is the radius r, so there's an acceleration, okay? And so it's not a back and forth, it's a center-directed acceleration, but nevertheless, it's going to radiate. Okay? And so it's going to radiate electromagnetic waves.
electromagnetic waves, they are real physical entities. We were talking about that in the relativity. The idea that light, which is a form of electromagnetic wave, or is an example of electromagnetic phenomena, is a physical, real physical entity. It carries momentum, it carries energy, I stand in the sun, I warm up, et cetera, et cetera. I build a solar sail, I put it out in the solar system, and I can use the momentum from the light of the sun to push my solar sail spacecraft around. How many of you have heard of solar sail spacecraft? Yeah, so, okay, it's got momentum, energy, all that stuff. So this radiation that's coming off carries with it energy. From where is it getting this energy? From the jumping
electrons, from like orbital something.
Right, that's right. So it's getting energy from the electron, but we're still in the classical picture. You're jumping ahead to the quantum picture. No pun intended. So in the classical picture, it's got to get energy from somewhere, and where it gets it from is the energy of the electron. Okay, the potential energy, kinetic energy, all that stuff. So the energy reduces slowly. Okay, so the orbit drops to lower orbits. Okay, and it happens continuously, so it actually spirals in. So it does that. Okay, so here's the interesting thing. Rutherford, at this undetermined time in early 1900, came to the point where if you take all of classical physics, Newton's ideas, Maxwell's ideas about electromagnetism, et cetera, experimental observations showing that the nucleus is a small point particle surrounded by an electron, a small point particle, yada, yada. All the best physics at that point comes to this culminating point, which says that basically, if all of that physics were true, then if we suddenly made it true, then in the next nanosecond, all atoms in the universe would suddenly collapse in a blinding flash of light. Okay, so I'm looking around, this ain't happening. Okay, so something's seriously wrong. Okay, and the problem is deeply serious. Okay, so what we need is a mechanism which doesn't allow this kind of spiraling in. We need a mechanism for giving us a minimum energy. What is the smallest radius? What is the smallest size? Okay, and what's required here is, well, okay, so quantum mechanics comes along. And what it does, first of all, is it gives you this lowest energy, and it also explains why the electron is not radiating, okay, when it's in that lowest energy state. Okay, because remember, the electron is not on a definite trajectory. If it were true that the okay, suppose I had a minimum energy here. Okay, that means some kind of a minimum orbit like this. And you might think of Bohr orbit. Okay, let's go back to this picture. You might think of the Bohr atom. Okay? Suppose I had a particle. Suppose I had some mechanism which told me the smallest size of the orbit that's allowed. Okay, well that's all fine and well, but the fact is, so here's my electron orbiting around in that orbit, and it's still accelerating. It should still be radiating. So that doesn't make any sense. So you're saying there is a minimum, but yet it's still radiating. Where's that energy coming from? If the electron can't drop to a lower orbit, it can't give up any of its energy. So that's impossible. So quantum mechanics tells you two things. It tells you, one, that there is a minimum size, and two, it tells you that the motion of the electron is not like this. The motion of the electron is some weird, funny, kind of purely quantum mechanical motion. Okay? If you think about our particle in the box, okay, what we said is it's not plus p or minus p. It's plus p and minus p. It's in this weird state in which it's simultaneously moving to the right and moving to the left. Okay? So in that sense, it's not moving. So in the same way, the electron is in some weird kind of purely quantum mechanical state in which it isn't radiating. Okay? So, whoa, okay, so basically, so at the end of the day, I want you to get a sense that from this picture over here, I'm going to compare this picture with this picture over here and give you a sense of why this minimum energy state exists. So basically, if the atom the question we're asking is, what is the minimum size of the atom? Okay. Yeah. What is the minimum size of the atom? Okay. So one mechanism for making the atom small, the atom would like to get small because then the potential energy gets lower and lower and lower. Okay. So it would like to do that. So going back to our picture here, we have this. In the classical picture of the ball in the bowl,
Okay? The minimum energy was right here at zero. Okay? But then along came this purely quantum mechanical form of kinetic energy, which pulled this curve up. And so now we had a new minimum, okay? A finite size and a minimum energy that was not zero. Okay? So the same sort of thing happens here. Okay? So, so from the classical picture alone, the system would like to be as small as possible and have no motion. Okay? But then because of the purely quantum mechanical kinetic energy, okay, it expands the system. Okay, and it keeps it jiggling in this zero-point motion. Okay, and that's the effect of this curve. Okay, so this curve over here is analogous to this curve. This curve all by itself would say, hey, the atom can be as small as possible, and that's even better. The energy just gets lower and lower and lower. But then there's a purely quantum mechanical kinetic energy. The smaller you make the atom, particles are fundamentally claustrophobic. The smaller you make it, okay, the more freaked out they are. Wow, I'm, you know, the walls are closing in. I'm getting all freaked out. There's this sort of random kind of momentum, random sort of kinetic energy that exists, and that boosts the energy up. Okay, so at the end of the day, this energy here turns out to be the lowest energy state that the atom can have, including the classical potential energy and this purely quantum mechanical kinetic energy. So the point is that this whole problem is resolved by quantum mechanics. So this whole idea of zero-point energy, there being this zero-point motion, is what saves the day. It's what allows atoms to exist in our universe. Atoms could not exist in a universe described by Newton and Maxwell. It requires a quantum mechanical universe for atoms to exist. So I want you to appreciate that these ordinary objects that we see around us, tables and chairs and people and so on, are made out of atoms, and atoms are purely quantum mechanical objects. They could not exist in a classical world. So quantum mechanics is deeply important for understanding the nature of our universe. Okay, let's take a break for lunch.
Yeah.